Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 9th of June. And our guest this hour is Fred Burton. Fred Burton is the author of Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. He has a long career working in counterterrorism way back in the 1980s when he started this work, was trained to become an agent and worked with just a handful of other people with the Diplomatic Security Service and worked to uncover terrorist attacks or assassination attempts before they actually took place. He devised the first true counter-surveillance program employed by this agency, and it has saved countless lives since it was adopted in the mid-1990s. He worked in law enforcement before he started this kind of work, and it's really, so many reviewers have said it reads like a spy thriller, except it's nonfiction. Of course, he lived this life and has written about his years in Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. It has just been published in paperback and was a national bestseller when it was in hardcover. So he has a lot to talk about this hour. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send emails, the email address is talk@wpr.org. Of course, there's news today of the first Guantanamo Bay detainee who was indicted in the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in East Africa, arriving in New York to face criminal charges. Later in this show, we'll ask Fred about this ongoing controversy and what he thinks should be done with the detainees who are kept at Gitmo and whether or not it should be closed. So, a lot on the table. Fred, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Tell me about the training. You know, you have these great chapters of the training that you went through, looking over your shoulder all the time, making sure nobody gets you. What a way to live. But you had your dog who would go for runs with you. Tell me how you decided to make the transition from in law enforcement to working as a counterterrorism agent.
Kathleen, I had a wise old police sergeant that encouraged me to look at the different federal agencies, and as opportunity presented itself, I took advantage of applying to the State Department. And you got to remember that we were called Admiral Bobby Inman hires after the U.S. Embassy bombings in Beirut, primarily in 83 and 84. Ambassador Bobby Inman from the CIA and NSA chaired a task force and said the State Department needed many more special agents. And I was one of the first classes of special agents hired. And right out of training, I went into the counterterrorism division. And like most people, you've got this vision of kind of a James Bond world. And of course, I was shocked to find out that I was just one of three of the original agents assigned to this unit, and literally the world was our patrol beat.
It was amazing to me, Fred, that you were one of three. You guys had so much work to do, piles and piles and piles of work, and you had to come up to speed on some fairly significant issues of the day, given folders Beirut 1, Beirut 2.
Yes, it was certainly a trial by fire. Mm. My old boss, Steve Gleason, who was a wonderful mentor at the time, he had literally been debriefing hostages himself and traveling to Beirut when the first embassy bombing occurred. And he looked at us when we first walked in and as the new guys and immediately started to assign us cases. So I literally from day one went in this immersion program of studying groups like Hezbollah and the Abu Nidal organization and Black September and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And at times I thought that it was just tremendously overwhelming for me because I was not an Erebus specialist by any stretch of the imagination. But it was extraordinarily difficult at times, and at other times it became one of just sheer fright.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sure did. I was amazed by the hours. You weren't paid very much in this position. Initially, it was, what, $27,000 a year. And you were working all the time. 4 a.m, the phone calls would come. You'd work till 2 a.m. Some nights, you never got any sleep at all.
Yeah, but, you know, it's no different than what any dedicated public servants are doing. Today, there's thousands of agents doing what we did at the time. And, you know, it was one of a more of a mission-oriented mindset that I had, that what you would see, Kathleen, and most people fail to recognize this, that you only see the disasters, the embassies lying in rubble or the plane crashes or the assassinations. But for every one of these events that occur, you're looking at serious threats. At times, there would be 10 to 15 a week that we were looking at, where either sources have said that Hezbollah is planning a terrorist attack or the Abu Nidal organization is looking at these targets. And literally, it became very difficult to delineate what to take seriously and what not. And of course, if you drop the ball, literally you could have a smoking hole in the ground or a plane blown out of the sky. So there was just this feeling of like clouds or dread on top of you all the time.
Mm-hmm. Which made it very hard for your family, I'm sure. You had a son, and your wife worked as an accountant, a very good accountant, you said. But in order for you to be able to have a family life, you had to sacrifice a lot of that. And it, later on in your life, it was decisive in terms of whether or not you were going to do something else.
Certainly. It was early on when I was first married, it was very difficult because we would deploy to events or, in essence, travel over to Beirut and bring a hostage out, or travel to Wiesbaden, Germany to debrief a hostage or to interview victims of terrorist attacks that were medevac there at the U.S. Air Force medical facility. And so I would deploy at times for days and sometimes weeks, depending upon the type of incident we were on. And of course, I could not tell my wife where I was going at the time. But in essence, she would eventually figure it out when radio or news or TV had some event on. And so she would figure that that's where I'd been.
She would figure she must have been. She had to suppress a lot of deep fear, I'm sure. Oh, that's where he is. I better not think about this.
Well, she knew it was my job, and right. It was a job that I took very seriously. And you really look back on that time frame, and you have a lot of guilt. There was a lot of regret, and certainly writing the book was very helpful to me from just the mental aspect of that, trying to put some of this down on paper, because you certainly saw a lot of tragedy, and you saw a lot of things that most people never see. Our brave men and women are doing that every day in places like Iraq and Afghanistan today.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the ear story. Early on, you were looking at one of the files. I can't remember exactly which one, and you didn't know what was in this plastic bag, and it was an ear.
Yeah, that was a bit shocking.
I had been a
police officer, and I'd also been a emergency medical technician as a volunteer with the Bethesda Chevy Chase Rescue Squad, and so nothing was unusual for me, but one of our original case files from the Beirut bombing had this little plastic evidence bag that said Department of State evidence in it, and it had this little shriveled up looking kind of mushroom. And it turned out that it was the suspected bomber's ear that we had retained in the case file. And so it was not unusual to find mysterious things like that in the case file at times. It was just the nature of the job.
Right. Your boss at DSS in this three-person office filled with files and all kinds of work that three people couldn't possibly do told you to understand terrorism today, and we're talking about the mid-80s. I'm wondering if it's still true now. You must understand Black September.
Absolutely. And I think that that's very important. And I go around and talk to college students and new counterterrorism agents. And it's important for the agents to know how we got to where we are today. And in order to study the methodology and the tactics of these groups, you really have to look at organizations like the Black September Organization, as well as groups as like Hezbollah, and to understand how al-Qaeda studies their targets, because it's very important to know how they do their surveillances and how they have their cover for action and their cover for status, which are terms as to how they blend in to conduct their surveillance. And that becomes very, very critical when you're looking at these terrorist attacks. And the term is, you know, as you walk back the cat and try to peel back the onion as to how these groups carry out their attacks, you really do need to understand the tactics.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me as though early on when you were working, obviously you were vastly understaffed. You just needed many, many more people to accomplish the work. What about now, Fred? Do we have more people who are doing the methodical and dangerous work that you were doing back in the mid-'80s?
Yes. Today, the counterterrorism system is much more efficient than it was back on my watch. And there's thousands of agents assigned to this process today. And our country is much better off because of it, because we have a much more robust analytical capability. I mean, when I started, we did not have computers, and literally I was writing names of suspects on index cards and keeping them in a journal that I kept. And so you have very sophisticated computer systems today that can link images and identify acts of pre-operational surveillance. And it's all very automated, and our name check capability today is quite efficient. Literally, when we first started, it was very disparate. If you wanted to check the name of a suspect, you would have to contact the FBI, the CIA, and DIA, and then individually have to request those. And at times it would take hours, if not days, to get record checks back.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, and let's the book, the latter chapters in the book talk about a certain case where it was best for not very many people to know about what was going on. Can you talk about that and why it is that you need to hold some of these cases close to the chest or you may miss the mark?
What I quickly found out in this business, especially inside the Beltway in Washington, information is power. And whoever had the information first to bring it to the attention of the White House or the National Security Council, that's what I found used to drive a lot of the issues. And you can't get out of the politics of this topic. And I think you can even see that today.
Sure.
But it's important that you have compartmented operations. I mean, think of the recent arrest this week of the two Cuban intelligence officers, one of which had been working for the Cubans for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And had access to a lot of information at the State Department. And so the investigation of those kinds of cases are critical, that they're compartmented and that you operate on a need-to-know principle and in order to protect sources and methods.
Yeah. Tell us the story of chasing Ramzi Youssef, because it really is – It tells so much here of how you decide whether or not informants are giving you good information and how you didn't want many people to know about this and how actually people's egos got involved and you got, even though you did phenomenal work here, other people wanted to take the credit for this. It's really an interesting story.
Well, the Ramzi Youssef case, and of course he was the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing, really is a perfect case study in success as well as failure. We had opportunities to capture Youssef that were literally bungled inside the Beltway, where we divulged information to the Pakistanis by playing all the rules for liaison channels. And the Pakistanis, their intelligence service specifically, had tipped off Ramzi Yousef to our interest in him, and that the fact that we had an informant that had told us where he was. And so I learned my lesson in that case, that if you play by those kinds of rules at times, that literally you could lose your window of opportunity to capture a bad guy. And Yousef, bin Laden himself has referred to Yousef as the perfect terrorist, and had told Mohammed Atta to study Ramzi Yousef if he wanted to know how an operation should be carried out. And he had bombed airplanes and was planning to kill the Pope in the Philippines, and I'm convinced he would have been successful in killing the Pope if he had not caught his apartment on fire in Manila. But we had an informant that came to us through the Rewards for Justice program, which was another program that we started within the Diplomatic Security Service, which is a very effective counterterrorism tool. And the informant told us that he had befriended Ramzi Yousef, and that Yousef was coming into Islamabad. And he did not know exactly when, but he knew that he would be there within 24, 36 hours. So the informant turned out to provide some very accurate information, and we paid him $1.2 million in cash to help set up Yousef, and he did. And he called and said Yousef was at this hotel in Islamabad, and two of our very brave agents went over, Bill Miller and Jeff Reiner, and knocked on the door, and there was Ramzi Yousef in this little Fleabag hotel, surrounded by improvised explosive devices.
Oh my gosh.
That he intended to insert into these little baby dolls, that and his desire was to scatter these on various planes, U.S. flag carriers, and try to blow up several different planes. So it was a job well done.
Yeah, it was. But you didn't get very much pat on the back for it, did you?
No, but Kathleen, I was not really expecting any pats on the back. I figured that was our job.
Right.
And no sooner had we arrested Yousef that just about every government agency in town had claimed credit for his capture.
Right, I'm sure.
And I can remember turning on our local radio station shortly after his arrest to hear that the FBI had captured Ramzi Yousef in Islamabad, Pakistan. And that was the farthest from the truth. And so you learn quickly that, information is power, and whoever gets that information to the media first, it becomes a soundbite and forever emblazoned on people's minds.
Right. And then there's you weave together poignant stories of important people in your lives, one of whom was your dad, who I'm convinced, because of what he did for his life, you chose a similar kind of path. But he was worried about you during all of that, wasn't he, that they were out to get you in some way, and you had this poignant conversation with him shortly before he died, that you were okay.
Oh, yeah. It was after we captured Yousef, the witch hunts begun, and people were outraged that they were not aware of this, and they wanted to know how this small little group of agents had done this, and in essence, they conducted several investigations of us for capturing Ramzi Yousef, and it was a troubled time because I felt, and I still do, and if I had to turn back the clock, I would not have done anything differently. That if we had not stopped Yousef, he would have blown several planes out of the sky and killed more innocent people. And it was just very surreal that based upon this, we were investigated for this event. And the investigation eventually went away, thank goodness. But it just kind of showed you the world we were living in, where at times things just appeared to be upside down, and we had done nothing illegal. We had just simply done what we thought was best to capture a international terrorist. And of course, it was hard to keep that from your family. And my parents, my dad, and my wife were concerned about me during that time period. But I knew I would be okay, that at the end of the day, we had done what was the right thing to do.
Right. Sometimes you just have to hold that within you, right? Nobody's going to publicly say, hey, you, this is ridiculous. What you're doing is ridiculous. You have to carry on quietly by yourself.
Yeah. Yes. And, of course, you know, you live with that, though, and there is a human toll involved in that. And that was one of the main reasons why I chose to kind of get out of the business. I figured I had done all I could do, and it was time to pass the torch and let others go forward.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, Fred, about the kind of work your dad did.
Well, my father was in the military police, and I actually had been in World War II, one of the military police officers assigned to Nuremberg during the war trials of the Nazis. And so I guess I had listened to his stories of just being a police officer in that time frame and battling true evil with the Nazis and witnessing their executions and so forth I guess that must have stuck in my head. So when I decided to get into law enforcement, there's probably no doubt that I was carrying on that, and I think he was very proud of what I was doing, and knew that we were at times battling true evil, which I think we were. I mean, you know, granted, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, but when I looked at some of these events, I would try to keep the politics out of it, and look at the sheer brutality of
yes.
what was taking place, because there appeared to be at times no rhyme or reason for setting off bombs and killing innocent people or you know, driving car bombs into daycare centers and so forth, and regardless of the political motivation of the group carrying out the attacks.
Yeah, exactly. We welcome phone calls for you, Fred. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Fred Burton is our guest. His book is Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. It has just been published in paperback. He's one of the world's foremost experts on security, terrorists, and terrorist organization, now vice president for counterterrorism and corporate security at Stratfor, an influential private intelligence company. He is the former deputy chief of the Diplomatic Security Service, the Department of State's counterterrorism division, and he has worked in this field for a long time, since the 80s. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Dave from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first thing that strikes me is with your guest, if your wife stayed with you through all this, she is absolutely an angel. two questions. I guess they're related. When we invaded Iraq, do you think that helped keep us safer, or did it make our country less safe? And what do you think of President Obama using his family's heritage of some of his family were Muslim, and he's using that to try to deflate, or to try to, from the inside, try to make something collapse. And I wanted to get your guest's comments on that.
Okay. Yeah, good areas.
Thank you. Well, first, thank you for the very kind words about my wife. She has been I've just been blessed to have her with me for so many years. Your first question regarding Iraq, I think that what most people fail to recognize when you look at those kinds of decisions are there's two aspects that mainstream media really never focused on, and that was you had Egyptian President Mubarak, as well as King Abdullah in Jordan, both telling the White House that Saddam Hussein had WMD. And then, of course, you had the CIA asset that was codenamed Curveball that was also reporting that. And the intelligence business is not a perfect science. You're trying to fill gaps, and you're constantly dealing with intelligence gaps. So you sit down and you look at what's being passed to you through your foreign intelligence service liaison channels. You look at what you might have via human intelligence. You look at your signals intelligence, and you try to reach a conclusion. Now, most people also forget that Iraq was a state sponsor of terror, and I had specifically worked cases involving the Iraqi intelligence service detonating improvised explosive devices at visa lines in U.S. embassies around the globe. So the Iraqis were shipping explosives via their diplomatic pouch. We had intelligence information that they were using silenced weapons and supporting other groups. So I can see how that decision was made. You know, in retrospect, was it the best decision? Probably not. You know, going into Afghanistan to take out the command and control node and cell of the base, al-Qaeda, was the right thing to do, in my opinion. And it dispersed al-Qaeda and, quite frankly, killed a lot of them. On your second question, I think that President Obama has a difficult mission. I've worked for Republicans and Democrats in Washington, and I've become somewhat apolitical because I've seen balls dropped by both Republicans and Democrats. And if you look at the counterterrorism business, it's very cyclical. It literally is like a at times like a roller coaster with funding and agents and so forth. And it's not unusual for new presidents to change policies and processes and different attorney general guidelines. So I think that President Obama's mission to reach out to the Muslim world is a positive one, in my personal opinion. And I think time will tell as to the results of that.
Do you think that this much acclaimed speech in Cairo does much, if anything, to sort of disarm bin Laden?
I don't. I think bin Laden is one of these individuals that, regardless of what steps we take as a nation from a foreign policy perspective, there's going to be the radical fundamentalists that are going to adhere to his rhetoric, and as well as Dr. al-Zawahiri's, regardless of what we do. There's very little we're going to be able to do to disarm that component, which is very, very small within the Muslim community.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back for a moment. When you use these words, true evil, and you talk about your dad confronting true evil in Hitler and in the Nazi regime, and true evil in radical fundamentalist Islam, How do you understand that? And you were thinking about it, I'm sure, every day for all of these years, and you still are in the work that you do. Where that comes from? How is there anything you can do to confront that true evil? And it does exist in the world.
No, it's something that I've struggled with for years, just trying to figure out what causes individuals, whether it be you know, the Himmlers of the world and the Nazis of the world to carry out these atrocities, to, you know, what causes that suicide bomber to drive that vehicle into the Jewish daycare in BA, Argentina, or a Timothy McVeigh to drive the Ryder van into the federal building in Oklahoma City. And I don't know. I kind of would look at these events and process it from a technical perspective, from a forensic perspective, and that helped me at the scene of these events just do my job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have an answer for you, Kathleen, on that.
Mm-hmm. It must have been so hard to be at the scene of these events. so hard?
It's very difficult because if you look at the results of these car bombings and plane crashes, mm-hmm. they're not pretty. They're very violent. There's bloodshed and extremities and body parts all over the place, and it's difficult to make sense of what occurred. But we tried to the best we could, and we were very successful at doing that. And I would approach it from the standpoint of, if I could learn as much about that event, I perhaps can take away from that some lessons learned to help that or prevent that from reaching that level of carnage in the future.
Right.
And because of our work and some of these bombings and attacks, we were very successful at countermeasures to prevent others from occurring. And there is no 100% security. You're not going to be successful from stopping them all, but you certainly can learn from how they occur and apply those tactics to try to keep other people alive.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk more about what those countermeasures are in a moment. Thanks for the call. We go to Ron from Bellevue, Iowa. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Fine, Ron. How are you?
Good. My question is about 9/11. From what I understand, it's just bits and pieces. There was a woman in the FBI office in Minneapolis saying, what are these guys taking flying lessons in Arizona for? They would get into the planes, they wouldn't take them off, but they just learned how to fly them. And she was yelling and screaming, how would that be missed, I would ask your guest. I mean, is it just another, you know, part of all the information that comes in and you've got to weed it out?
It's a very good question, and it boils down to your lack of tactical analysis. In looking at all these attacks, there's two failure points. One is your lack of human intelligence, and your second is your lack of tactical analysis, making sense of the information. Not only did you have the Minneapolis memo, you had that Phoenix memo that was very similar with FBI agents reporting to headquarters that they had a group of individuals that only wanted to know how to take off, not land. Obviously, in retrospect, that those two should have been married up together at FBI headquarters and the information disseminated to the intelligence community, and you would have been able to determine that you had some sort of operation in the works. But if you look back to the pre-9/11 FBI, it was in many ways highly dysfunctional when it came to counterterrorism. And you had tremendous wars between the FBI and the CIA and information being withheld from each other and so forth. And believe me, I've thought about those two memos a lot. And again, hindsight is always 20/20, and we're always brilliant after the fact. Obviously, those should have been followed up on. They weren't. And as a result, you had 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I understand when the Clinton administration had the change of order, they said, watch out for Al-Qaeda. And the Bush administration just said, we're not going to worry about that. We're worried about Iraq. We want to go to Iraq, so we're not worried about Al-Qaeda. Did that happen? I mean, maybe my information might be wrong. I don't know.
Well, in essence, what happens when you have a change of administration, every administration comes in with their own agenda, and they have their own priorities. And the transition phase is very, very difficult. Fortunately, you have a bunch of career GS-12s and 13s that transition very well, and it doesn't really matter who's in the White House on any given day because they're just going to do their jobs. And these are the folks that would be processing information. Now, when you think about the transition from the Clintons to the Bush administration, terrorism was really not a focus. And it's very hard to explain, and it's very hard to to understand that today, because we're living in a post 9/11 world, and we've invaded two countries, and we have TSA, and we all get harassed when we go onto airlines today. But if you step back to September 10th, 2001, it's very difficult to even remember our country and our world on that day and the process that we were all working under in that time frame. So it's an interesting question when you start thinking about the issue of the transitions of governments and transition of White Houses and what's going to be a priority going forward.
Mm-hmm. Were there points, though, Fred, you're a pretty measured guy here and have to be in the work that you do, but you've been working on horrendous cases, loss of life. We had the first World Trade Center incident. You were investigating things all over the world. Didn't at some point you jump up and down and say, oh, we just have not paid enough attention, and I've been wanting people to pay attention to this for years.
The problem with that, Kathleen, is I was not high enough up the food chain, so to speak, to make a difference. Literally, it takes individuals at the National Security Advisor position, White House vice presidential position, not necessarily the president, but it takes an appropriate level person to focus on these events. And if you don't have that laser focus, and again, remember, in a pre 9/11 environment, what was the strategic threat to America? I mean, I can't tell you the number of diplomats that I've investigated that have been assassinated abroad, and you might get two or three lines in a national newspaper or a radio blurb, and then it would move away. And throughout most of the 80s, even though we had the horrific embassy bombings and the Marine Corps bombings and the murder of William Buckley, our CIA station chief, we had attacks all around the world. And it was like most of America didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Okay, let's go to – thanks so much, Ron, for your call. Let's go to Tiger from Green Bay. Hello? Are you there? All right. Evidently, Tiger is hung up. We'll pause for a moment and return and welcome more phone calls. Lines are open for our guest who's written not only fascinating, but it's really well done. The book is Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. Fred Burton is our guest, one of the world's foremost experts on security, terrorists, and terrorist organizations. He started working with the Department of State's Counterterrorism Division back in the 80s, and is former deputy chief of the Diplomatic Security Service. He has been all over the world. He was given the task in this office of three people in the 80s that he was the Mideast guy. He was going to handle terrorism that was going on in the Middle East, and immersed himself in what was going on there. And countermeasures, and we'll talk about some of those that he learned to implement after horrendous events took place. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Fred Burton, our guest, and let's go back to phone calls. David from San Francisco is next. Hi, David.
Hey, greetings.
Hi.
You know, I wanted to ask about compartmentalization of evidence and you know, gathering evidence. And one of the base points that I wanted to ask about, on September 11th, there were actually three buildings that fell, the two major towers, but the third building, Building 7, was the headquarters for the New York office of the CIA, the New York office of the FBI, and then also the Federal Trade Commission. So all of those offices held a huge amount of evidence. And so when that Building 7 fell, there was a huge amount of destruction of evidence. And so I'm wondering, first of all, with the stock market swindles, Arthur Andersen and whatnot, there was a lot of data that was lost, but there was the famous put options of 9/11. Somebody had done stock market insider trading. They knew that there was something that was going to happen, something bad that was going to happen to American Airlines and United Airlines and the company that had the insurance policy on the World Trade Center. So I'm wondering about the gathering of evidence once that building fell, Building 7.
in looking at that, what you're referring to was some allegations that there was some foreign manipulation of the markets, primarily Saudi money that I believe, if my memory serves me right, that had transacted during that time period. If you think of the buildings from a physical security perspective, most of the physical evidence on past cases and so forth, although they would be held at the field division level, primarily within, for example, FBI New York and the U.S. Secret Service field office also was destroyed in that bombing. Most of that is held in Washington or at Quantico. And for the CIA, they don't necessarily have possession of any physical evidence. They're going to have classified message traffic capability, for example, telegrams, cable traffic, and reports and so forth. That's all going to be back at Langley.
Mm. Thank you very much for the call. Let's talk more about countermeasures. Are there a different set of countermeasures that you would recommend an institute after each one of the incidents that that you worked on? Or are there some that have become across-the-board effective countermeasures?
Well, there's three specific things that that I worked on that we had uncovered that clearly saves a lot of lives. And one of them is standoff distance, meaning the distance from the detonation of the car bomb to your structure. And that's why you'll see most of the military bases and new U.S. embassies constructed have a large distance between the street and the building. Mm. Standoff distance helps you significantly. What we also learned in looking at these attacks were that flying glass from windows kills a lot of people, and it sometimes does more harm than the actual improvised explosive device cooking off. So there's some countermeasures with some window film applications called Mylar that you could apply to windows to keep the glass from shattering. And the third application was the program that I developed with pre-operational surveillance, meaning you send agents out, surveillance out, looking for surveillance. There's a terrorist attack cycle that takes place, and it's very similar to how a criminal studies their target on the street. That criminal may surveil their target for 15 seconds, or a terrorist like Al-Qaeda may surveil their target for 2 years. But there's a time frame involved. And if you know what to look for, you can actually turn the tables on the bad guy or the terrorist and look for those pre-operational surveillance indicators. And I talk about that in my book, Ghost, how that's been probably the most effective tool at preventing acts of terror from taking place in 20 years.
Mm. Thanks, David, for your call. Tiger from Green Bay.
My sincerest apologies. My speakerphone was on before I had trouble getting in. I'm
okay.
Parking on the side of the street.
Okay, thanks.
My question was, first of all, you know, you hear a lot about hearts and minds and whether or not if we had broader appeal to the Arab world, as President Obama attempted in his Cairo speech, that would stop a lot of the terrorism recruitment and a lot of the assistance from the moderate public with the terrorists. Is that a theory that holds water? Is it a PR war in a lot of ways, or is that just a squishy liberal theory? And I'm a squishy liberal, so I can say that.
Well, I think it's a very good question. I was a tactical operator. I was not sitting in our small little three-man office drafting talking points for the president or foreign policy statements. I think when you start looking at the hearts and minds issue, this is a strategic goal that obviously over time you would like to think you can work towards that. But like I tell my bright young interns and analysts at Stratfor, you've got a job in this business for the next 20 or 25 years. because what I found is that you're still going to have terrorists killing people. And yes, it's nice to hope that you can work towards the winning of the hearts and minds, but in reality, on a practical application, the threats don't stop coming in, and you would like to think that you reduce them, which is another important part, that the threat mitigation here, the investigation of the actual threats before they go into the terrorist attack cycle is a very important part of this business. And and that's where there's a tremendous amount of career development and job security and investigating these very serious threats that most people never see every day. And it's probably a good thing that most people don't see them every day, or nobody would get on a bus or a subway or an airplane.
Hmm. Anything else, Tiger?
No, that was a great answer. I thought perhaps because he's on the ground doing investigations, he found a lack of cooperation from the populace or increased cooperation with the populace resulting. But he's saying, hey, the threats are out there. They're right. Not going to diminish in this generation, and we've got to combat them as they come at us. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
I think that's what
correct.
I heard. Yeah.
That's correct.
Thanks, Tiger, for the call. How do you know there's really an intriguing chapter? I mean, it does read like a spy thriller when you're on the heels of, it's your first assignment of somebody who might have valuable information for you about an upcoming terrorist event, and you got to go to this really scary part of Philadelphia and meet with somebody who turns out to have no information of use to you. How do you, because this could go on, and I'm wondering how often it does go on in your business, how do you determine a good source?
It goes on every day, and that's part of the job. You would get a lot of different intelligence reports in, and depending upon the validity and the credibility and your gut as to what should take seriously. In essence, whenever you have an informant, a human informant, it's best to always want to talk to them so you can look at them eye to eye and see what they have to say and hopefully polygraph them at some point in time. But that's usually very late in the game. You ask that informant to provide proof of bona fides of how do they know that specific information. And at times, it's not rocket science. They may know because their brother or friend is involved, or perhaps they're directly involved, like the informant I work that set up Ramzi Yosef. That informant was simply scared. He did not want to die and did not want to carry one of these little baby doll bombs aboard a plane and blow himself up. So he was committed to the cause, but only to a point.
Right.
He was not a suicide terrorist. So you take statements, you attempt to validate them, you give the source additional requirements, which are basically the term that is used, which is additional questions. You go back to the source and you ask the source questions that you already know the answers to, and embedded in that question list might be two or three that you don't have an answer. But you keep them honest as best you can. And to Tiger's point, and I, our earlier caller, I want to say one thing, that you learn quickly in this business that there is no friendly intelligence service. And that's the other issue, meaning you're living this life where you're greatly dependent upon foreign intelligence, whether that be from the Israeli Mossad or the Jordanian GID, but in reality, you soon recognize that each nation is protecting their own national security, and rightfully so, and that you have to vet all reports to your own standard and try to do the best you can making sense of these fragmentary pieces of information.
Hmm. We have a minute left. I do want to. I need to ask you about Guantanamo because it's so much being debated right now. What's the best strategy here? Does it need to be closed? And how do we figure out the people who were there, the couple hundred, what they did, if anything?
Well, you have about 15 to 20 hardcore Al-Qaeda there, the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed a variant that needs to be prosecuted under U.S. Federal court, in my assessment. Then you have a whole host of others, that the bulk of which are Saudis, from what I understand, that you would want to repatriate and turn them back to their home country for whatever their own services want to do, or a judicial system. So the challenge you have is not turning individuals over that are going to come back and haunt you in Afghanistan or Iraq. So that's really the challenge with these Gitmo prisoners. The actionable intelligence out of Gitmo is long over. There is no more actionable intelligence you're going to get out of Gitmo.
Fred, thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book. You're a heck of a writer, too. Enjoyed the hour.
Thank you.
Fred Burton, and the book is Ghost: Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. It's now available in paperback and has been published by Random House. So that's it for this this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee, and for all of your calls. Thanks as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Many more hours of great conversation ahead, so stay with us. It's a minute before 11, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.